Good afternoon, everyone. It's Dr. Nigro again with our next episode of Psychology Unplugged. I'm really enjoying this experience, interacting with a lot of you guys and responding to your questions. It's just been really, it's a pleasure. I look forward to doing this every week. So today's topic, my wife kind of brought this up and she said, "You ever going to do a topic on what you do every day?" I was like, yeah, probably, maybe I should do that, which we're going to talk today about neuropsychological evaluations. Okay. What is a neuropsych eval? It's the mechanism by which we are able to accurately diagnose psychiatric conditions and neurocognitive and neurodevelopmental disorders. So I've said this before, I think my perspective is therapy and medications without a full neuropsych eval is akin to having surgery without an x-ray. It's not that people can't do treatment, it's just a neuropsych eval is several hours and tons of data that is able to delineate with specificity how someone's symptomatology, psychiatric or neurocognitive or neurodevelopmental, manifests idiosyncratic to that person. And like I said, I don't do much therapy anymore, but I can tell you I could have be seeing somebody for 2 or 3 years and without having information from the Rorschach or the MMPI or the thematic apperception test, there is no way I would ever know the true psychological constitution of the person sitting across from me. All right, so what is this process? It's predicated on a structured diagnostic clinical interview. So what I tell patients is, I can't explain how my mind works, but it does. And I have to ask questions in a very specific way. And if I cut you off, it's not because I'm not interested or not don't care about it. It's through the process of asking questions and watching how people respond to questions. At the end of it, I've always done this since I graduated from my doctor program, right in the upper left-hand corner of this 36-page structured diagnostic clinical interview that I use, I kind of write what the diagnostic picture is, and I do the testing, and I was going to see how close I am. So when I say watching how people respond to questions, this is really important when you're asking about history of suicide, history of homicidal thoughts, history of self-injurious behaviors, history of substance abuse, history of engaging in high risk behaviors when you're looking sometimes possibly borderline personality, bipolar disorder. Body language is incredibly important in diagnostics. A person cannot hold two simultaneous thoughts. So this was a recent study in the New England Journal of Medicine that it looked at being able to tell when people are lying. You know, they found that when a person has to determine or decide whether they're going to tell the truth or tell a variation of the truth, their pupils dilate. And they found that pupil dilation is also related to when, whether it's intentional or unintentional, when someone is presented with a question where there's some sense of discomfort, pupil dilation is the indicator that the brain is not able to hold with equal magnitude two converging thoughts. So once we get through this structured diagnostic and clinical interview, I tend to be overly anal when it comes to testing. I'm very grateful and blessed to have the training in clinical psychology and all the training in neuropsychology to do a full comprehensive neuropsych eval. And the analogy I use is a neuropsych eval is kind of like if an MRI could talk. So the dimensions that we typically measure are memory, verbal memory, visual memory, both on short-term recall and long-term recall, reaction time, psychomotor speed, simple attention, complex attention, sustained attention, working memory, cognitive flexibility, processing speed, executive functions, and gross overall motor speed. Those are the core components of neuropsych testing. When we do testing, we use what's called a pure normative sample. So these are individuals, when you're developing tests, that have no history of psychiatric conditions, no history of head injuries, organicity. And so from a neuropsych perspective, the neuro piece, you're comparing people with no organicity, no pre-existing brain damage. Kind of, that's your pure sample. So we also compare against someone's age, gender, laterality, level of education, and current occupation or work status, including if someone's even on disability. The second part, I don't always do it, is IQ testing. I do it when it's relevant. There's some fluidity to neuropsych abilities. IQ testing is a different dimension in and of itself. I tend to use the Wechsler scales. Those are the most widely used IQ tests, the child version and the adult version. And you may have heard of the Stanford-Binet. That's incredibly extensive, incredibly long to give, and is really useful for people at either the very low end of the intellectual spectrum and at the very high end of the intellectual spectrum. So IQ typically yields, when you're looking at the Wechsler scales, verbal comprehension, perceptual reasoning, working memory, processing speed, visual spatial abilities. And in neuropsych, people will, you know, my IQ, the full scale IQ is important. It's interesting, but individual performance and something called subtest scatter, where you're comparing each subtest against each other. And there's something else called the cognitive proficiency index and general ability index, where you're able to pull out the impact of processing speed on individual performance. But I think I would save IQ for a whole different topic, because that's an entity in and of itself, because there's different definitions of intelligence from a clinical perspective, versus if you look at Howard Gardner's model of multiple intelligences, like artistic intelligence and musical intelligence, poetic intelligence. And again, that's a different topic in and of itself. Once we've kind of finished the core battery of the neuropsych tests, I use a wide spectrum of norm-based symptom rating scales across a wide spectrum of symptoms. OCD, depression, anxiety, stress, sleep, panic, PTSD, neurobehavioral symptoms, measure things like dizziness, feeling numb, clumsiness, memory loss. Again, these are subjective, but they are also have a normative component to them, where somebody would be mild, moderate, severe. Watching people take tests is also another important part. So, you know, sometimes with kids who are highly oppositional, they're just giving you random answers. And if they finish in a very short period of time, I don't have a lot of confidence in what those results yield. Moving into the other aspect of the psychological component, this is where you're able to crystallize the diagnostic picture from a psychiatric perspective. So I like using the MMPI, the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory. There's a new one that's out, so we kind of have a choice between the second version or the third version. Interesting fact. The first version that was developed, they had a mistake, because the normed sample were family members of patients in the Minnesota psychiatric hospital system, and what we know is there's a strong genetic link between many psychiatric disorders. So the revised version of the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory, the adult version, the second edition, is incredibly valid. Then there's the other piece. So the MMPI, the Milan scales are really good. The adolescent psychopathology scale are really good. And again, these are very robust tests in terms of they're able to detect if someone's lying. They're able to detect if somebody's trying to fake symptoms, say they have more problems than they do. I tend to see that more when someone's looking for what we call a secondary gain. There's a motivation to look impaired. So, for example, a workers' comp claim, a disability claim. And sometimes when people are just feeling so overwhelmed by life and symptoms, they think everything in the world is coming at them. They endorse tons of symptoms. And there are times when, you know, the adult version is 567 questions, that all this information is completely invalid because they're endorsing symptoms and everything. So those are examples of objective personality assessments. The projective ones, where you're getting into the Rorschach, I just read a new book that came out about the Rorschach, which is actually now admissible in court because the data and the scoring system, and I think it was probably 6 years of my doctoral training, every year a class on it, because it is absolutely fascinating. And I tell my wife, I tell my colleagues, to this day, I am still impressed at how accurate this test is at delineating with such specificity the psychological architecture of an individual. Because and people, they either love the test or they don't like it because no one has any idea what the test is looking for. So when you're administering a test like that, in essence, the person who you're administering it to, all they have to work with is who they are. And if you go back to the episode I did just on general personality, my belief about myself, my belief about other people, my belief about the world in general, that's where all of that stuff is able to come out, and it yields tons of information. So I usually will write 15 to 20 pages on the different aspects and dimensions of the Rorschach. Now, the thematic apperception test is another projective test, and it's more or less a storytelling test where you're showing a patient various cards, and the cards actually are, the pictures are actually real. I don't have the dates or the artists, but they're much older in terms of history. And the reason for that is there is no current connection or context for which a person to reference that or say, oh, that's a scene that I've experienced or that I've witnessed. So you're basically asking a person, tell me a story that has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Tell me what each of the characters are thinking, feeling, and experiencing. What is the outcome of the story? And what's really interesting, and sorry, the overall theme or emotion of the story, what's really interesting is when you're writing everything down verbatim, and my handwriting leaves a lot to be desired. It's horrible. But so there's a lot of symbols and whatnot, so it triggers me to know what I'm writing. But you find through giving, I give between like 10 to 15 of the stimulus cards, because each one evokes a different response. They'll pull more for depression or pull more for achievement, pull more for violence or conflict. And as you do an analysis of the responses, it's really interesting, again, because these are assessments of personality. It really, you see consistency in the stories. You seek, this is again how the person is perceiving the world and how they're seeing it from this perspective. Now, can these results change? Yes. Should they change? Yes. So if you diagnose, say, somebody with major depressive disorder, recurrent, severe, without psychotic features, with anxious distress, it's a long, fancy title for depression. The person is in therapy, hopefully in productive therapy, and I retest them 2 or 3 years later. You would hope that the Rorschach, the TAT, and the MMPI, or MCMI, those are the Milan scales, you would hope that those would change from the previous assessment. Now, when you get into like neurodevelopmental disorders, like ADHD, and it's really important, what testing is able to do, from, if I'm flipping back to the neuro piece, is kids in particular that have the inattentive type of ADHD. Now, there's no such thing as ADD. Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder, predominantly inattentive type, predominantly hyperactive type, or combined presentation where you have inattention and hyperactivity. Now, the latter two, the hyperactive type and the combined type, those kids and individuals tend to get recognized earlier on because they are so motorically dysregulated. The term we use is hyperconnectivity, excessive motor dysregulation. So this is the kid that was kicking the chair in the front of class. This is the kid who could not sit still. And it's literally painful for these kids. The ones I'm especially concerned about are the kids with undiagnosed inattentive type and processing speed disorders, because there's no overt manifestation of these. And I typically see from the transition from elementary to middle school, middle school to high school, high school to college, and even in adult, until the demands of the situation bump up against the ability level, you may never see the deficits. So I usually will ask people who are, if they're on a stimulant medication, to come in not on their stimulant medication. A little different when you get into like guanfacine and Strattera or atomoxetine, because they've built up in the system. The ADHD will still show, the severity necessarily won't. So kids really go under the radar. And I'm talking, if you're getting C's, D's, you're friendly, you're coming to school every day, you're not causing any problems, they're often mislabeled as lazy, unmotivated, daydreamers, not caring. It must be a family systems problem at home. And I think I mentioned this before, the precursor to undiagnosed and untreated ADHD, the precursor to antisocial personality disorder is untreated ADHD. And that's a separate topic in and of itself, and we'll do that soon. But these kids, again, rarely is it ever just ADHD. There's usually, in my professional experience, there's usually a secondary diagnosis of a mood disorder. Doesn't mean it has to be severe. It could even be subclinical, where there's anxiety and depression, because if your output is not reflective of the feedback you're getting in terms of, say, just for grades, for example, or an adult, employee review, you start to internalize it. So, I wholeheartedly believe in this process. It's scientific. There is an art to it. Like I said, when you get into the behavioral observations and building rapport, and that's a huge part, because you're meeting somebody, at least in my experience, I'm meeting somebody for the first time and I'm asking them tons of questions. So I spend a lot of time really just building that rapport and connection, so I have more confidence that the responses I'm getting from the narrative of the structured diagnostic clinical interview are accurate. The hardest part, I've mentioned this before, is doing the feedback sessions. So in my office, I have a TV screen on the wall, and I'll pull the eval up on the screen, and I will walk people through it. And by saying it's the hardest part of what I do, so diagnosing, writing the evals, they take time. They're extensive. There's tons of information. It's when the person comes back or the parents and their child come back, because my job is essentially to tell you what's wrong with you. And I take that very seriously, and I place a lot of emphasis on instilling hope that whatever it is, these are things that you have. These are not things that you are, to not define yourself by it. Now, some people do. It's like, oh, I have ADHD, so that's my ticket out. I don't have to do chores. Yes, you're going to have those people, but you can rein them in pretty quickly. So, is my job to put someone in a box? Yeah. But if you don't know what, one, that there is a box, two, what the box looks like, and three, what's in the box, how can you do effective medication management, and how can you do effective psychotherapy? Because the neuropsych eval is the contents inside the box. So I would encourage you, if you, yourself, someone else, to gain a better understanding, if you're struggling academically, if your family member has been diagnosed with a mental illness, and they, or has been, but you send something, testing. It's like if an MRI could talk. It's a vehicle that is available. It's extensive. It's intense. But the amount of information that you're able to get is only going to enhance your treatment and maximize your potential for success in treatment. So, general overview of neuropsych testing. It's fun. Grace of God, I never feel like I'm working. I love what I do. People are fascinating. No two people are alike, and that's part of the human experience, the human condition. Hope everyone is doing well. Again, I appreciate everybody following the program. Feel free always to reach out to Psychology Today. And until we meet again next week, be well and take care of yourselves. Bye-bye.